Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Much to the surprise of the Democratic establishment, Senator Bernie Sanders is posing a real challenge to former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. Next Monday is the Iowa caucus, then Tuesday, February 9th, is the New Hampshire caucus. According to the polls, the races are very close. Of course, the outcomes will all depend on voter turnout. Over the course of the campaign, Bernie Sanders' popularity, his campaign contributions, and huge crowds have forced Hillary Clinton to embrace a more progressive platform. Both candidates support equal pay, universal pre-kindergarten, family leave, and overturning Citizens United. They also both oppose the Keystone Pipeline and the TPP. But Clinton came to the table late on Keystone and the TPP. They differ on key issues like health care, energy, Wall Street regulation, and free college tuition. So on today's Your Call, we are going to talk specifically about where they differ on the issues. So many in the media are talking about the fact that they're going after each other, but we are going to talk about the issues. So joining me to talk about the main differences between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders are three guests. Katrina Vandenhoevel is editor and publisher of The Nation. The Nation recently endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. The editors write that a political revolution is not only possible but necessary. This is The Nation's third endorsement in a Democratic primary. And Katrina Vandenhoevel joins us on the line from New York. Hi, Katrina. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Rose.
It's great to have you. We are also joined by Ali Bogan. She is the political and campaigns editor at RH Reality Check, a daily news publication focusing on reproductive health and justice issues. Prior to joining RH Reality Check, Ali was associate research director at Media Matters, and she joins us from Mount Rainier, Maryland. Hi, Ali. Welcome to the show.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. And we're joined by Norman Solomon. Norman is a journalist and longtime activist who has written a dozen books on media and politics, including War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. We'll talk about foreign policy with Norman. He was an Obama delegate to the 2008 Democratic National Convention, and he joins us on the line from Marin. Norman, it's been a while. It's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thank you, Rose.
Great to have you. So I want to start off by talking about campaign contributions and money. So Bernie Sanders has really surprised the Democratic establishment by raising $73 million. Hillary Clinton has raised $112 million. According to the International Business Times, Bernie Sanders has raised nearly as much as Clinton in the final quarter of 2015. The Sanders campaign has accepted more than 2.5 million online donations. The average donation is $27, $27 for Bernie Sanders. And then on the Clinton side, 760 of her donors are listed as a CEO. The average CEO donated $2,300. So when it comes to money and donations, Katrina, what really strikes you as the major differences between these two?
Well, I think part of the reason voters see in Bernie Sanders a tribune of integrity is the way he has raised his campaign money. I mean, he doesn't owe his political career to the big money, the super PACs, and freed from these special interests. He's freer to take the bold measures that he speaks of, whether it's breaking up the too big to fail banks, investing in public education, breaking the power of the insurance and pharmaceutical cartels. I mean, Clinton, to her credit, out of the pack, said she would repeal Citizens United, but she, is getting big money via super PACs, raising funds from millions. I mean, from thousands of Wall Street and other big money contributors. So, you know, I wrote a column today in the Washington Post about this narrative that's out there, Rose, about how Bernie Sanders is sort of the dreamer, that it's a choice between head and heart, Hillary Clinton head, Bernie Sanders heart. But I think what Bernie Sanders has done here is shown his viability, and I hate to say the media often measures a candidate's viability by how much money they raise, but in this case he's raised small donations, which is liberating, so that he's has a real strategy for change embedded in the very way he is raising funds. I think it's a model for other candidates, by the way, around this country. to use social media in the ways Bernie Sanders has, to be competitive in the process, but with small donors, empowering small donors in the process.
And Norman, what are your thoughts about this? I mean, I think it's so important to really follow the money, because on the Hillary side, and you can't, I mean, following the money on the Bernie side goes to individuals. Those are just the facts. Average donation is $27. On the Hillary Clinton side, she's got lobbyists from Monsanto and ExxonMobil raising money for her.
Well, it's traditional for candidates for president to denounce big money as they take it in concentrated doses. And I think, as Katrina is saying, Bernie Sanders' campaign provides a model that for him is really lifelong. And it tracks with not only the money, but just the politics of how Bernie Sanders has wended his way through the House and the Senate and now on the campaign trail. Traditionally as well, politicians, whether they acknowledge it or not, see social movements as subsets, or want those social movements to be engines that are subsets for their campaigns. And Bernie Sanders quite rightly has it correct that political campaigns for office should be subsets of social movements. That's how we ultimately get change. So I think that the money path is really part of the political path.
And Ali, what would you add on the money and the contributions?
Well, I think that an important thing to consider here is also how the money interest could be influencing positions on this. There was a report out, I believe it was a week or so ago, from The Intercept on how Hillary Clinton's platform on healthcare, although she has been consistent in supporting a universal healthcare platform, has shifted, and maybe that could be in part to donations that she, or not donations, rather speaking fees she received from healthcare insurers, and now she supports the Affordable Care Act as opposed to Bernie Sanders' single payer system, which would provide more money to those same people that supported her with speaking fees. So we see how that is also playing an influence there.
Rose, if I could add,
sure.
Our former reporter on money and politics, Lee Fong, did that piece. Ali refers to at The Intercept. He also did a very interesting piece about a week ago on this was a group of about 10 former national security defense types who issued a letter in support of Hillary Clinton. And it turned out that half of them were receiving money from defense industry corporations. So I think it's critical, as you began the segment, to say follow the money.
Right.
Follow the money. And I think independence and credibility in our political system, if Bernie Sanders' model can really become a template and show at least some victory, it becomes one to prove independence and credibility, and may that be the new test of credibility and viability and not how much you raise from lobbyists.
Well, Bernie Sanders has brought up Hillary Clinton's speaking fees in almost every debate. Mm-hmm. Now, she usually diverts attention, but she did give an interview to NBC's Meet the Press, and she says that my speeches have not led to conflicts of interest. She said, quote, I gave speeches to a wide array of groups, from healthcare groups to auto dealers and many, many more. What they were interested in, because what we talked about, was the world. Coming off of 4 years as Secretary of State in a complicated world, people were interested in what I saw and what I thought. And according to reports, we've had Li Feng on talking about this, in 2013, she was paid $3 million from Wall Street to give speaking, to give speeches. And unfortunately, reporters aren't allowed in those talks, and we don't know what was actually said.
And she won't release the transcripts, according to Li Feng's reporting.
Right.
I mean, one thing it does is, she didn't address it last night in the forum in Iowa. It didn't come up. But, you know, it does contribute to the kind of mistrust or sense of, you know, lack of credibility on these issues regarding taking on the banks, taking on corporate power.
Well, let's talk, kick off talking about the issues by talking about abortion and reproductive rights, because it's been kind of shocking to see these debates, and very few questions have been raised about abortion and reproductive rights at a time when we have major, major attacks happening. In the 43 years since Roe v. Wade, states have enacted 1,074 abortion restrictions. 288 have been enacted just since 2010. Last week was the 43rd anniversary of Roe v. Wade. So, Ali, Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders have very high ratings from Planned Parenthood and NARAL, but Hillary Clinton has received the endorsements of Planned Parenthood and NARAL. Are there any major differences between Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders on reproductive rights?
Yeah, well, you know, both of the candidates are very similar in values. We see that they value health care. They say it's a human right. They both believe that. They both think that we should oppose the Hyde Amendment and try to overturn it. So we see those things. That's consistent. But there are differences in the way that they frame the issues and how they will get there. So, for example, the Hyde Amendment has been in the news a lot. When Clinton was endorsed by Planned Parenthood and NARAL, she started to speak out about how Hyde, which bans federal funding for abortion, is really bad. And she is one of the first candidates to really, really strongly talk about Hyde. And we didn't see that from Sanders for a while, although he had initially, in 1993, he did vote against Hyde. But he hasn't been talking about it up until this last past Friday on the anniversary of Roe v. Wade, when he issued a statement formally condemning Hyde. But still, there are differences in the way they talk about it. Sanders, who claims to be running on economic inequality issues and how we are going to address them, doesn't frame abortion access or the Hyde Amendment as an economic issue, but we know that it is one. As Hillary Clinton has pointed out in her interviews on Hyde, it disproportionately impacts low-income women who can't afford an abortion. So we have state restrictions adding to the burden of paying for an abortion. Women now have to go deal with child care, additional waiting times for an abortion, traveling longer and longer distances just to find a clinic. And the Hyde Amendment, which makes it so that federal funding and Medicaid funding can't pay for that abortion, is just compounding on those costs. So in debates, especially debates where they're talking about the economy, it's strange that Sanders has not brought up Hyde or frames it in that way. But Clinton has. Not in debates, but in interviews.
And so just to let listeners know more about the Hyde Amendment. So the Medicaid program, which covers health care for low-income people, covered abortion just as it did other medical procedures. So in 1973, all women had the ability to obtain an abortion. But in 1976, Congress passed the Hyde Amendment, which banned Medicaid coverage of abortion. This is the only medical procedure that has ever been banned from Medicaid. And here we are in 2016, and it's still on the books.
Yeah, I'd like to jump in on this, Norman. In terms of historical context and the economic rights of women and children as well, for that matter. In 1996, Hillary Clinton helped spearhead the passage of what was called welfare reform, which included kicking women off of welfare assistance after 5 years. And the legacy and impact, the day-to-day reality of that, what it was called welfare reform, is still with us. And I think it's stunning that the news media have not really provided a historic context, mm-hmm. because there are few people in public life, arguably today, who have really a record of damaging the health and well-being of women as Hillary Clinton in that context of supporting the welfare reform law that was passed way back in 96. And it has had continuing negative effects on literally millions of women and children.
So could I jump in, Rose?
Sure.
I mean, you know, I do think Bernie Sanders was tone deaf. I think it was last week when he referred to Planned Parenthood as part of the establishment. But I feel that, he spoke quickly afterwards. He wasn't attacking the mission or good works of Planned Parenthood. What he was taking aim at is perhaps their political strategy in endorsing Hillary Clinton. Bernie Sanders wants to increase funding for Planned Parenthood. He supports equal pay for equal work. He wants to pass more family and medical leave paid. And what I think is important, building on what Norman said, he is for increasing the minimum wage to $15, which would disproportionately improve the lives of low-income women, of poor women, women of color in this country. Hillary Clinton stuck at 12. And so I just think, we need to be clear about Bernie Sanders' commitment to an issue that is vital, and one certainly that Hillary Clinton is fair to draw a stark contrast to ideas put forth by the Republicans who want to roll back the civilizing advances of our time.
And, Ali, also on paid family leave, there are some differences. They both support paid family leave, but they differ on how to pay for it.
Yes, exactly. So Bernie Sanders supports the Family Act, which he introduced with Senator Gillibrand, which would offer 12 weeks of paid leave to care for a new child or a sick family member. And he proposes paying for that through a payroll tax on workers. And Clinton has been very vocal speaking out against raising taxes on middle-class Americans to pay for these sorts of programs. Meanwhile, Sanders argues that it is the kind of program that all Americans should have a financial stake in. Clinton's platform would pay for this paid family leave. She also supports 12 weeks paid family leave by taxing wealthy Americans. And she argues that that's enough to pay for it.
And, Ali, are there any other differences that you'd like to talk about before we let you go?
No, I think that's it.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us, Ali, and thanks for your reporting.
Thank you for having me.
That is Ali Bogan. She's political and campaigns editor at RH Reality Check, a daily news publication focusing on reproductive health and justice issues. And joining us for the rest of the hour is Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor and publisher of The Nation, and Norman Solomon, a journalist and activist and the author of many books. Today we are talking about the differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton. We want to talk about specific issues and key differences. And so if you'd like to join us, and a few people are, have already called in, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What really strikes you about the differences between Sanders and Clinton? What questions do you have and what issues are most important to you? 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. And let's go to David in Oakland. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Good morning. Thank you. One of the big differences I noticed right away is the death penalty, which Clinton is pro-death and Bernie is not. And the Glass-Steagall 21st Century Plan with Elizabeth Warren, he's made a plan for this, whereas that was rescinded during the Clinton era. The other thing that Clinton was for was the Patriot Act, if people have forgotten, about the wiretaps, email surveillance, right down to even public library searches. And Bernie was not pro for that. I just think we can forget gender politics and horse races and vote for the people who are with our convictions.
All right. Well, thank you so much. You brought up some very important key differences.
Thank you.
Thank you. Let's go next to, and we'll dive into these, especially Glass-Steagall, Wall Street reform, minimum wage. Let's go next to Ruthann in El Cerrito. Hi, Ruthann.
Hi there. I wanted perhaps Norman Solomon to comment because I've worked with him before on the Medicare for All, Mad as Doctors, Tell Doctors track. But what I wanted to comment on is looking at not so much what the politicians say, but what they will do when they're in office. And looking at Hillary's track record, it's really not very good. And I think Bernie is pushing her to the left, and she will talk a good talk on health care. But on the last debate, when she commented on needing to preserve the Affordable Care Act because of how much work went into it, it struck me as an argument of let's not let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And I just don't see Bernie going anywhere near that kind of compromise. And I think that considering her funders and backers, there is no way she would go against Big Pharma and the insurance industry after her acts in Congress as senator and as Secretary of State for the past 10 years. I just don't think her track record supports what she is saying now. And I'm wondering if, particularly Norman Solomon, do you think she will backpedal if she gets in?
Well, her past record gives really
no reason for confidence that she would fight for health care for all or to challenge the dominance of the big pharma and the insurance industry. You know, when she was challenged on this in recent weeks, including in the debate, Hillary Clinton fell back on that during the 1990s she was bruised and attacked by the insurance industry. That's her narrative, which is basically misleading, because her very Rube Goldberg complicated managed care plan that she promoted and fought for and did get attacked for profusely during the Clinton administration was occasion for a split between the huge insurance companies and the medium-sized insurance companies. So they were divided, and the ones that didn't like the plan did attack her. But there's no indication that she is willing to or has a plan to fight for health care for all. And as Bernie Sanders pointed out in the last debate, to which she really had no comeback, under the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare, 29 million people are still uninsured, and others are underinsured and have high deductibles. In terms of records, there's something that I've never seen that I can recall in the last year and a half or so of coverage of the national presidential campaign that has increasingly included Bernie Sanders, and that is that Sanders had a major role in improving the Affordable Care Act, which I certainly think is inadequate. But one of the things he did, which underserved health care clinic areas around the country are continuing to benefit from, is he fought for better reimbursement rates for federally qualified health centers. And you can go to major places in the Bay Area, such as the Petaluma Health Center, and see the results, because Bernie Sanders, as a sort of the price for his vote for the ACA, was to insist that the bill include these higher reimbursement rates off of Medicaid, or in this state, Medi-Cal, so that it was viable for people who otherwise often would not get care to get quality care. So I think Bernie Sanders, not only as an authentic long-term fighter for single-payer Medicare for all, we should really note what he's accomplished in the past.
Well, why don't we hear from Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton in their own words on health care, because this is one of the key issues where they differ. And this is from a recent NBC debate.
We need to take.
Senator Sanders, well, if I can, you know, I have to say I'm not sure whether we're talking about the plan you just introduced tonight or we're talking about the plan you introduced nine times in the Congress, but the fact is we have the Affordable Care Act. That is one of the greatest accomplishments of President Obama, of the Democratic Party, and of our country, and we have already seen 19 million Americans get insurance. We have seen the end of pre-existing conditions keeping people from getting insurance. We have seen women no longer paying more for our insurance than men. And we have seen young people up to the age of 26 being able to stay on their parents' policy. Now, there are things we can do to improve it, but to tear it up and start over again, pushing our country back into that kind of a contentious debate, I think is the wrong direction.
I have to talk about something that's actually working in our state.
No one is tearing this up. We're going to go, but with the secretary.
So if I could, Rose.
Yes, Katrina.
What struck me, and I agree with everything Norman said, I think particularly important and underreported is the role Sanders had in improving the ACA. But, you know, what Hillary Clinton was doing there, first of all, was disingenuous. She is so tightly wrapping herself in Obama's legacy, this continuity in a time of desire to change, and she's not even speaking to the history of how reform has happened in this country. It has happened. She should be saying Obamacare is limited. It is not serving us that well, as Norman pointed out. We must build on it. We must build on it, and Medicare for All, which is enormously popular, not just with the Democratic base, but with millions of people in this country, she should be speaking aspirationally to that. Bernie Sanders is telling us not to lower our sights. He's changing what millions of Americans can think is possible. But above all, we have a broken healthcare system. We're outliers in the Western industrialized world, which guarantees affordable healthcare for all. And what Bernie Sanders, when he speaks
of health care as a right, as a right. He is speaking very clearly in the tradition of this country's history, invoking, in fact, Franklin Roosevelt in the Economic Bill of Rights, where Roosevelt, and he wasn't run out of Washington in 1944, spoke of America's right to housing, to health care, to a job with decent remuneration. So for Hillary Clinton, you know, she disingenuously argued that someone was going to rip up the ACA and start all over again. Bernie Sanders isn't going to do that, but he's going to speak to what could be done in this country if we had a more logical, less monopolized by lobbyists system.
Yes, and I would add that the aspirational realities, if you will, of the Sanders campaign has already had very important effects in terms of public discourse and really tracks with the origins of this campaign, where Hillary Clinton had the inevitability and Bernie Sanders had the possibility. And it's through organizing and looking to the grassroots rather than top-down donors and mainline media that we've seen this change. And really, Bernie's campaign and the millions of supporters, contributors, have really had to swim upstream against just a deluge of misinformation. Just one quick example, last Friday in moderating a forum on the PBS NewsHour, Judy Woodruff said that, she said point blank, most Americans don't want single-payer health care. When you look at the polls, actually, that is false, even if you take into account it depends on how the questions are asked, but Medicare for All has strong majority support. And I think this goes to, you know, an underlying broader application to what we're talking about. There was a column recently in the New York Times by Paul Krugman where he basically tried to instruct people that change is incremental in this country. You can't have drastic change and all at once. And I think Robert Reich, among others, has properly taken issue with that. And here I think is a key point that, yes, if you look at the long sweep of history, change in this country has been incremental. But it can seem to happen fairly quickly because of the aggregate effects of people's organizing, the civil rights movement, the gay rights movement, many other movements have created change through day in and day out work that comes to fruition kind of like the lily pad effect, where there's one or two lily pads and then it seems all of a sudden the entire pond is filled. And I think that's what we're getting from the Bernie Sanders campaign.
Yeah, what Norman said, I mean, we're living in a movement moment and there's a sense of movement time where there's an incremental, but suddenly things come together and there's an opening. And I think Bernie Sanders saw that opening. There are others who could have stepped into it. But because he's channeling so much of the movement energy, electrifying young people also, that he is speaking to the possibility of a theory and a strategy of change that is different than the incrementalism of Paul Krugman champions. I just want to say two things. One thing that strikes me, and Norman brought this up, and he's a real student of this, so forgive me if I don't phrase it in the right way, but media, that Bernie Sanders has gone from just, you know, 3% to 39% more important, that there's no inevitability anymore, that he is more than a possibility, didn't happen because of media coverage, I'll tell you that. This past summer, the media lavished, slavishly, obscenely, so much attention on Donald Trump and his rallies, when Bernie Sanders had thousands of people, thousands, coming to rallies across this country. It took Bernie Sanders, I would argue, his fundraising prowess, to wake up a media to his possibility and real possibility, because sadly our media measures viability in these ways. But Bernie Sanders has been a long-time champion of a different kind of media. He understands it's not liberal media bias, which people whine on about. It's a corporatized media system that is rigged versus public interest and democracy. When he stood on this stage, the first debate, and there should have been more debates, which is another scandal. When he said to Hillary Clinton, enough with your emails, the second part of that answer wasn't really covered, but what he was really saying was enough with the obsessiveness, the legitimate coverage, but obsessiveness with what is not truly consequential and meaningful for millions of people's lives. He has spoken for a free internet. He has spoken for breaking up mergers of these mega conglomerate media operations, and he has spoken about the need to return to the 1934 Telecommunications Act, which, and this is where we need to retrieve our own real and radical history, reminds people that the airwaves belong to the people, not that you would know it from what we're getting on cable TV and 24/7 reality show Donald Trump.
Katrina VandenHeuvel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine. The Nation endorsed Bernie Sanders for president. This is The Nation's third endorsement in the Democratic primary. We're also joined by Norman Solomon, a journalist, activist, and author of many books called War. His latest is War Made Easy. And I do want to say we did reach out to many Hillary Clinton supporters, and they were not able to join us. We didn't really want to have so much as a debate today. You can probably tell that Katrina and Norman are Bernie fans, but we really wanted to talk about the differences and issues. So what issues would you like us to talk about? What do you think are the key differences? If you're a Hillary supporter and you'd like to ask Norman or Katrina a question, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. After the break, we will talk about foreign policy. In a recent Al Jazeera piece, Norman Solomon writes, while Bernie Sanders is a tiger on economic issues, he is a restrained cat on foreign policy. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways you can take part in the conversation on Your Call. On the phone, by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or by going to yourcallradio.org, the website. If you'd like to participate in today's show by telephone, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. TALK. Coming up at 11 o'clock, it's BBC World Have Your Say. How is Europe treating migrants? That's the topic of discussion on BBC World Have Your Say in less than half an hour from now.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will have a conversation with award-winning environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She writes that while rain is one of the trickier parts of the atmosphere to measure and to understand, changing rainfall patterns are among the earliest and most obvious signs of a warming planet. We'll talk with Cynthia Barnett about her book, Rain. That's tomorrow. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Well, next Monday is the Iowa caucus, and Bernie Sanders is posing a very real challenge to Hillary Clinton. Many in the Democratic establishment are surprised by this. And so today we are talking about their major differences among a variety of issues. We're going to talk about foreign policy. We'll get to Wall Street regulation, free tuition, also later in the show. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. We tried to reach out to Clinton supporters. Unfortunately, they were not available. So if you are a Hillary Clinton supporter and you'd like to call in to talk about why you're supporting her, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. And we have an email from David who says, Clinton voted for the invasion of Iraq. Bernie voted against the Iraq invasion. He also wanted to talk about Bernie as mayor of Burlington created affordable housing by a public domain issuance. But let's talk a little bit about foreign policy, because, Norman, this is where people on the left are really criticizing Bernie Sanders. He has said in an NBC Meet the Press interview that he would continue the drone policy. Unfortunately, he wasn't asked to elaborate, so we don't have that much information on it. In a piece you wrote for Al Jazeera, you write that while Sanders is a tiger on economic issues, he is a restrained cat on foreign policy, hardly laying a claw on elites for their huge Pentagon budgets and intervention overseas. So far, you write, he has not been willing to pounce on Clinton's hawkish approach to the world, but that may soon change. And it hasn't changed.
Well, that piece ran in October. I think there's been a general evolution from last summer, which I found a disturbing moment. Bernie's campaign was already in pretty high gear. There was literally nothing on his issues page about foreign policy or war. That has shifted somewhat in a good direction. But it's no secret that Bernie Sanders, as a House member and senator, has not had a focused interest on foreign policy nearly as much as economic and trade and social justice issues at home. There have been some important moments in the last few debates where Bernie Sanders has distinguished his worldview on foreign policy and war from Hillary Clinton, and I think that's to the good. We need those distinctions to be clear. There was a pattern that Bernie Sanders got into early in the campaign last year when he kept saying that Saudi Arabia, quote, needs to get its hands dirty, unquote, by doing more military action in the region, which, given what Saudi Arabia is already doing in Yemen, for instance, with its leading a coalition air war that's killed thousands of civilians already, it's really, I think, not an appropriate kind of position to take. I think Bernie has somewhat toned down that approach, but for those who have a sort of a systemic and, I think, far-reaching critique of what the drone war is, for instance, in the great book by Andrew Coburn, published last year, Kill Chain, Bernie's worldview is still too conventional, it's still too traditional, and doesn't really break with the mold of perpetual war.
If I could I? Sure, Katrina. In our endorsement, we noted the distinctions between Senator Sanders' approach and Secretary of State Clinton's approach. We did say the senator hasn't talked as much as we would like about global challenges and opportunities, urge him to focus more on national security and foreign policy. I think he has, as Norman pointed out, he has evolved. I mean, in the first debate, he spoke of the danger, the wrongheadedness of the United States as the policeman of the world. He said the U.S. must not be involved in perpetual warfare in the United States, in the Middle East. What's striking is that, for example, yesterday's CNN poll shows Hillary Clinton with a commanding lead in foreign policy experience. I had wished last night Senator Sanders would move beyond Iraq, which is a very important illustration of the idea that experience is not judgment. But he has much more to say, if he would, which is that Hillary Clinton hasn't learned. I mean, she's championed regime change in Libya, and that's left behind another failed state becoming a base for ISIS. She pushed for toppling Assad in the Syrian civil war, lobbied for arming the Syrian opposition. She's calling for a no-fly zone in Syria, which has been opposed by the Joint Chiefs of Staff and President Obama. There's an irony here that he may have, for better or worse, because one wants to push him, he may be more in common with President Obama's foreign policy than Secretary of State Clinton's. The larger point, which Norman made well in his Al Jazeera piece last August, is if you're a progressive, and Bernie does this sometimes, but you've got to take on the Pentagon budget. You've got to take on the secret war budget. Because if you don't, you're never going to have the public, the funding to make the necessary investments in rebuilding this country, in dealing with the ills of the domestic U.S. economy and its problems. So I don't know what's holding Bernie Sanders back. Clearly, he knows his message, fundamental core message, inequality, Wall Street, integrity, independence is resonating, but I do think he's going to have to speak more about foreign policy and national security as the primaries continue.
He, for years, has said he wants an audit of the DOD. Late last year, he says, we're wasting money while soldiers are on food stamps. He said that at a rally. But he doesn't elaborate very much. And like you said, Katrina, I mean, a lot of people watch him talk about foreign policy in the debates, and it seems like he just doesn't have a grasp of the issues.
Well, to be fair, he has lifted up what even the Pentagon considers one of the great national security threats of our time, climate change, climate crisis. And I think that's fair to include in this. It gets dismissed too quickly, I think, by those who consider national security solely military challenges. But there's no question that Bernie Sanders should be speaking more, should be drawing out the distinctions, and, you know, showing that he has a command of this arena in a compelling way.
Yeah, that's a great point, that far and away the best, most visionary leader through his legislation and campaigning is Bernie Sanders on climate change. And I want to note that this morning in the New York Times, David Brooks has a piece that goes a step further in conflating angry aspirants for president. You know, this has been a media theme for many, many months that I think in a bogus way conflates right-wing, jingoistic, nativistic populism represented by Cruz and Trump with very progressive populism from Bernie Sanders. And what David Brooks does in his piece today is to say that his nightmare is that Trump or Cruz or Sanders would become president. And I think this, you know, this is, reminds me of what C. Wright Mills talked about when he referred to crackpot realism, as he called it. When you have a policy that is embraced by all the other candidates for president in both parties, other than Bernie Sanders, that will take the planet over the climate cliff, and Bernie Sanders is a voice of sanity, and yet we have so many pundits saying that he's not the realistic one.
Well, Norman brings up an important point. As I said earlier, there, it's not just the David Brooks, but it's the Paul Krugmans and liberal commentators who are saying Bernie Sanders is not a realist. I would argue, as Norman did in terms of, you know, talking about the movements and where we're heading, that the new realism has to be defined as someone who's willing to take on the rigged economic political system, the corrupt political system, work hard to defeat it, and take back a government that works on behalf of the common good and for people. And if until we do that, we will be on a downward spiral heading toward plutocracy and oligarchy and all those big words, which actually mean ordinary people will continue to get shafted.
Well, we have an email from Philip who says, please continue talking about their specific positions on the issues. And so we have a caller about foreign policy. Let's go to Elizabeth in Sunnyvale. Hi, Elizabeth. Welcome to the show.
Hi. So actually, my question was about Israel. I don't have a clue what Bernie's position is on Israel, and I was wondering if some of your guests, in particular maybe Norman, since that's, you know, a bit of an area of specialty for him, know something about that. But I had a really quick comment, which is that I'm pretty much a Bernie Sanders supporter. I like the way he talks. I like that he's, you know, tapping into this, the right sort of populism. But I don't like, not from any of your guests, but on online forums and stuff, there's a level of vitriol and hatred directed at Hillary Clinton that I don't see directed at wishy-washy centrist male politicians. And it's, I find it very disturbing.
Where do you see that? Because I've been hearing that, and I just don't see it.
Oh, God. You know, it's in the comments on things. And I can't remember because it's the type of stuff that I read when I can't sleep at 3 in the morning. So it's hard to remember where it is. I think maybe on Daily Cause.
Okay.
Some of the comments in there or someone. It definitely only in the comments, you know, so really random stuff.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are definitely on the left and are just vicious. I can't, I mean, even if it hadn't been 3 in the morning, I would have blocked out what they said.
Yeah, well, the comment sections can be pretty ugly.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. But let's talk just about the question you brought up about Israel, because I'm glad you brought up a specific policy. And Norman, Juan Cole had a good piece about Bernie Sanders on foreign policy. He wrote it late last year. Juan Cole writes, Sanders supported the Israeli attack on Gaza last summer, but thought the Israeli army was a little heavy-handed and overreacted with some of its actions, like bombing schools being used as civilian shelters. Sanders excused Israeli actions against Gaza civilian populations on the grounds that missiles were being fired from Gaza into Israel from populated centers. He goes on to just write about, you know, Sanders boycotting Netanyahu's speech in Congress in March, but he does sign on to the consent to resolutions to support Israel in their attacks.
Yes, you know, I think that this can be understood somewhat in the context of the very accurate point that Katrina made, which is that in the overall of foreign policy, really Bernie Sanders is much closer to President Obama than Hillary Clinton, who's been appreciably more hawkish, calling for a no-fly zone in Syria and so forth. And I think that certainly applies in terms of Israel. I think that Bernie Sanders' position is very similar to Obama's, very similar to the to J Street, which has its calls itself pro-Israel, pro-peace. In contrast, you know, Hillary Clinton is much more hawkish much more willing to give Israel a blank check rhetorically, and I would assume financially. She's written a number of pieces in Jewish publications in recent months, which I think could be called pandering. She's going to be more supportive of Netanyahu by far than Obama. She makes that clear. If you look at Bernie Sanders' senatorial website, you'll see that when Gaza was last being bombed and so many civilians were being killed with an unconscionable attack, he did say that he thought it was way out of proportion. So it was not really a mild criticism. But at the same time, he really has not challenged the U.S. government's willingness to continuously aid Israel without substantively pulling away.
Oh, did we lose Katrina? Okay, sorry about that.
I'd like to make a call.
We'll reconnect with Katrina. So basically, Norman, Bernie, can we?
And then dial your operator.
Sorry about that.
If you'd like to make a call, please hang up and try again.
So, Norman, your argument is that based on Bernie Sanders' record, you believe that he's closer to Obama on Israel.
Oh, I think his position is very similar to Obama's on Israel, and I think that notably, as with some other aspects of foreign policy, at least to a small degree, sometimes not a small degree, Hillary Clinton is more militaristic than Obama. One example, a concrete one, would be the Iran nuclear deal, where in the case of Bernie Sanders, like ultimately most Democratic senators, he supported it. And Hillary Clinton really waffled and, frankly, I believe, waited to see how the wind was blowing and then came out in favor of it, but in a rather equivocal way, which, if she becomes president, would be a rather ominous foreshadowing.
You know, if I could pick up on that, following the debate in Charleston, South Carolina, Clinton's campaign pounced on Sanders for saying the U.S. must, quote, move as aggressively as we can to normalize relations with Iran. You know, the nuclear deal with Iran was an important one, but I think what is critical is that it moved to improve relations with Iran and not just be stuck in the nuclear arena. Bernie Sanders has also called for dismantling nuclear arsenals and pursuing nonproliferation. As we speak, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists is having a press conference about the doomsday clock. Some of your listeners may know what that is. How close are we to nuclear peril? Now they include climate crisis. I don't believe they're moving it forward as they did last January, but it would be good to hear from all candidates in this race about the new nuclear arms race we may be embarking on, and to hear from Sanders about that. I will say that one thing Bernie Sanders has done is he has linked the crippling austerity we see around the world, particularly in Europe, to the austerity we see at home, for example, in Flint. He met with leaders of the Spanish left party, Podemos, of the Greek left party, Syriza, which is the governing party, and really was trying to carve out an anti-austerity, a global anti-austerity program, and in that, a kind of global New Deal for rebuilding the middle class. So I think, you know, there are various elements which engage him more, but it is the case that there is continuity with a lot of the Obama foreign policy.
And Katrina, what are your thoughts on people criticizing Bernie Sanders for saying that he will continue President Obama's drone program, which, according to the Bureau of Investigative Journalism, has killed 4,400 people just in Pakistan and Yemen alone between 2004 and 2014?
I think it will take movements to push Bernie Sanders to understand how counterproductive the drone program is, that it's creating and fueling more terrorism than actually providing any security. It's morally wrong. It's counterproductive. But I think that there is more opportunity, and I think Norman would agree with this. No political leader, without being held accountable, without movement pressure at his or her back, is going to take steps that are in accord with the more effective foreign policy, progressive foreign policy, or progressive agenda. Bernie Sanders, when he talks about a political revolution, is essentially saying, I want to mobilize millions of people to be the wind at my back, but that wind also has to be an accountability wind.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And one foreign policy aspect I want to note, which is a major distinction between Clinton and Sanders, is that Bernie Sanders has been a clear opponent of the expansion of NATO over the years. And Katrina has written so many great pieces for The Nation magazine about the Crimea, conflicts with Russia, NATO's role, and the news media have virtually failed to cover this important distinction by which Bernie Sanders is separating himself from a really aggressive stance that Hillary Clinton continues to embrace.
Yeah.
We have just about a minute and a half left, and we're getting a lot of questions from listeners who say, the biggest question of all is, can Bernie win, or will the Republicans destroy him? And if he is elected, can he get anything done given the environment in Congress? Quick thoughts, Katrina?
I think anything can happen in this volatile moment. Bernie Sanders, if you really want to go horse race, which I hate, you know, is doing better than Hillary Clinton in matchups with Trump and Cruz. I think he could have a wave election, meaning lots of people, turnout, big turnout, could be very helpful down ballot with Senate races as well. It's going to be tough, but I think it's possible.
Norman, final thoughts?
I think it is possible, and those of us in California and around the country have an opportunity not only to observe history in the making, but to make history, and that's our challenge ahead.
Well, Iowa is on Monday, and really it comes down to voter turnout, and we will be following that and then probably covering it on our Friday Media Roundtable. Katrina VandenHeuvel is editor and publisher of The Nation magazine, and Norman Solomon is a journalist, activist, and author of many books, including War Made Easy. Katrina and Norman, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us, and you can find articles about the differences between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton, there are many, at our website, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with award-winning environmental journalist Cynthia Barnett about her new book, Rain, A Natural and Cultural History. She writes that while rain is one of the trickier parts of the atmosphere to measure and to understand, changing rainfall patterns are among the earliest and most obvious signs of a warming planet. So what does the history of rain tell us about how we should deal with climate change? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, Matt Martin is executive producer, and Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.